Benny Goodman's If Dreams Come True, as performed by Dave McKenna, and we'll be hearing a little bit more from Dave McKenna later on Fresh Air today. The Return of the Sea Caucus 7 was originally intended for showing at just film festivals as a portfolio piece for its director, John Sayles, but it was a tremendous success at many theaters across the country, including Philadelphia, where it ran for several weeks. At about 4:15 today, we'll hear an interview with John Sayles. He'll discuss how he made The Return of the Sea Caucus 7 on a fairly low budget and how his days with Roger Corman, who is, of course, known as the King of the Bees, on projects like Piranha and Battle Beyond the Stars, how those days prepared him for working quickly on a low budget. We'll hear John Sayles and also Maggie Renzi, who co-starred in The Return of the Sea Caucus 7, at about 4:15. Today at 3:30 on Interval, Francis Davis will discuss the work of Billie Holiday in a special extended edition of Interval taken from the Fresh Air Archives. At 3 o'clock, we'll hear part two of a four-part series of highlights from the 1979 French Jazz Festival recorded in Juan-les-Pins, France. Today we'll hear two veterans of Benny Goodman's band, saxophonist Scott Hamilton and trumpeter Warren Vacher, and they'll be joined by pianist Dave McKenna, who will also play solo. Also on the bill will be Clark Terry's Big Bad Band on part two of the 1979 French Jazz Festival at 3 o'clock. Pianist McCoy Tyner is well known for his work in the John Coltrane Quartet, as well as for the bands which he has led since the late 60s when he left Coltrane. McCoy will be at the Robin Hood Del East next Wednesday, so we thought this would be a good time to rebroadcast an interview he recorded about a year ago, in which he talks about Coltrane and about his early days in Philadelphia where he grew up. We'll hear that interview with McCoy Tyner at about 20 of 3. In the spring of 1942, over 120,000 Japanese-Americans, men, women, and children, were evicted from their homes on the West Coast and herded into internment camps, surrounded by barbed wire, searchlights, watchtowers, and armed guards. The camps were set up by Executive Order No. 9066, signed by President Franklin Roosevelt, on the premise that Japanese-Americans constituted a threat to the security of the United States during its war with Japan, following the attack on Pearl Harbor in December of 1941. The internment lasted for 3 years. Although World War I set into motion the internment process, the seeds of anti-Japanese hostility had been planted long before on the West Coast, nearly 100 years before the first shot was ever fired in our war with Japan. Now, nearly 40 years after this chapter in American history, some Japanese Americans are demanding reparations for the time they and their parents spent in the West Coast camps. We're going to spend the first part of Fresh Air today with the Honorable William Maritani, who was a judge in the Court of Common Pleas in Philadelphia. He and his family were sent to an internment camp from their home near Seattle, Washington. He's very active in the Japanese American Citizen League and their National Committee for Redress, and has testified at hearings for reparations which have been held in Washington and Los Angeles. Judge Maritani is also commissioner on the Commission of Wartime Relocation and Internment of Civilians. Welcome to Fresh Air. Thank you for coming here.
Not at all. My pleasure.
The camps which were set up seem to have been a reaction to Pearl Harbor and to the war that the United States was getting engaged in with Japan. But there is an earlier history of hostility directed towards Japanese Americans on the West Coast. Can you briefly discuss that history?
Well, that comes under the general category of what might be called yellow peril. They called it yellow peril. Incidentally, that term yellow peril itself is a loaded term because let me try out white peril. I mean, you know, is anybody in favor of white peril? And it hosted first upon the Chinese when the Chinese came during the gold rush in the mid-1800s. And when they first came in, their episodes of lynchings in California, drunken miners going on a rampage, and generally brutalizing the Chinese workers in California. And then after they tired of that, and they started to clamp down on the Chinese, then they started to import Japanese to be laborers. And then this yellow peril racism was transposed over onto the Japanese, and they were considered threats. And some ridiculous stories appear in the books and in some congressional testimony about the Japanese taking over all the farmlands. And, you know, they were relegated to the arid areas that nobody else wanted.
Well, there was quite a bit of exclusionist sentiment directed towards both the Chinese Americans and the Japanese Americans. The Chinese population did ultimately diminish quite a bit, whereas the Japanese population didn't. Is there an explanation for that or a reason for that?
No. Generally, our immigration laws were anti-Asian. In 1924, for example, all immigration from Japan, from Asia in general, was prohibited to the United States. Yes, there was a great deal of racism directed toward people of the yellow race in the United States. For example, it may come as news to you that it wasn't only the blacks who were placed in segregated schools. There were segregated schools in San Francisco for Orientals, for example. My parents were not allowed to own land. They were not allowed, at one point in our history, Orientals were not allowed to testify in American courtrooms. And so the parallel with a black experience is very similar in many, many ways. It wasn't as long, of course, because the blacks ran into problems beginning in 1619. But there are many, many parallels.
Did those parallels foster any sympathy between Orientals and blacks as, you know, oppressed minorities in America?
No, I don't think so, because each of us was involved in trying to survive and not worrying so much about the other, trying to survive ourselves.
Well, what were some of the early signs of what was to come in the 40s to Japanese Americans? I mean, there was obviously a heritage of a hostility, but when could you tell that things were really getting more serious?
Oh, I could tell that ever since I was in elementary school myself.
What do you remember from that?
Having to fight in the schoolyard against racial epithets constantly. I remember even in college when I was vice president of the student senate, there were certain duties I was supposed to undertake as vice president, and those were denied to me. I remember that very distinctly. Those are not healthy signs for an American. As I mentioned to you before, our parents could not own land. Our parents could not gain fishing licenses, for example, denied many, many things. Also, when I saw fellow Nisei, that Nisei is a Japanese American, that means second generation. When Japanese Americans, for example, got college degrees as an architect and could not get a job, had college degrees as engineers and could not get a job in California, and I'm not from California, when they got teaching certificates, were not permitted to teach in the California schools. In other words, many areas of employment were not only made difficult, they were banned to us.
How about on movies or... I saw a cartoon once, a Popeye cartoon called Scrap the Japs,
yes,
which came out around the, the war, and it was, like, really quite obviously, you know, racist depiction.
Oh, yes.
What are some of your memories of that type of thing?
Sure. I remember seeing the same cartoons myself. You see, what cartoons do and movies do as well, and there are many movies, by the way, spawned during that period of time, which purportedly show disloyalty by the Japanese Americans at the time of Pearl Harbor or preceding it. Incidentally, along that line, I want to make it clear that the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover, reported that there was not a single incident of sabotage, espionage, etc. For example, there's a story circulating that at the time of Pearl Harbor, the sugarcane fields were cut in certain ways so that the arrow pointed to Pearl Harbor. Well, my goodness, if you can't find Pearl Harbor without an arrow pointing in a sugarcane field, that's ridiculous. And, of course, that's totally untrue. These are the kinds of things I experienced. One of the things, incidentally, about cartoons and so on, racism, the first step in racism is you dehumanize your victims. You do not make them human beings. You do not make them people like you and me and other Americans. This is epitomized, incidentally, most recently by our pogroms, and let's call a spade, what we did in Vietnam, some of the brutality. You don't kill Vietnamese. You kill gooks, and I don't know what a gook is, or a slope. You see, you first dehumanize them. You make them non-human, and then you are prepared to brutalize them.
Did cartoons or were the TV shows of the day, were they doing that?
You know, buck teeth. Do you see me with buck teeth, and I'm a full-blooded Japanese in terms of blood? wear big glasses, squinty-eyed, so forth. Let's assume they are. So what? That's the way God made them, you know, if that's the way they were made. And of course, they're not all like that.
How about bad comedians doing Jap impressions?
Sure. Bob Hope used to do it. I don't think he did it with any venal thought in mind, but that's part of the milieu or the culture, and you just dehumanize. For example, there used to be in the black scene, Step and Fetch It, you know, the soft shoe, lazy black. Then we had, even here in Philadelphia, the black parody on the blacks in the Mummers Parade until the blacks protested. These are the kinds of things that hosted upon Japanese Americans. You make a parody of them.
Now, did this take a sudden turn?
Oh, no. It was ongoing. And all it did is continue to accelerate.
Did you react differently to things like this than your parents did? Was there any generational differences?
I think so, very definitely. I think my parents were much more patient than I was. Remember, I was born and raised as an American, hated the things Americans hate, loved the things Americans hate, laughed at the things Americans laughed at, just like any other American. So when I saw these indignities as an American, I reacted as an American, and I despised them.
Okay, now on February 19th, 1942... President Roosevelt signed the Executive Order 9066, which led to the internment. What happened, though, after he signed it? What was the process? How did you find out what was going to happen, and what did you do next?
All right. At that time, by the way, going back and reconstructing it from today's perspective, we know now that President Roosevelt signed that at the insistence of the military. We also know that within 2 weeks, I think it was, General John L. DeWitt in the Western Defense Command set up the machinery for what ultimately led to the uprooting of the Japanese Americans. In other words, to use a street slang phrase, the skids were greased. Everything was all set up. This was not a sudden impulse thing. I learned about it when finally the order came out that you've got to leave. My hometown.
Now, how much warning did you have?
Well, we could see the storm clouds gathering. Ultimately, when we were told to leave, we only had 1 week notice. Now, I want to pause here a moment and give you the impact of that. Let's assume for a moment you are told today, 1 week from today, you've got to go somewhere. You don't know where, you don't know for how long, and you're told that all you can bring with you is what you can carry, your toothbrush, some clothes. What do you do about your dog? Well, that's a minimal factor. What about your goldfish? Well, we're not going to worry about. What about your car? We're not going to worry about that. Now, when you get to people who were in business, and a lot of them were in business, what about my crops? I have several hundred acres of strawberries. We're not going to worry about that. What about my tractor that I bought last year? We're not going to worry about that. What about my home? What about my farmland? What about all these things? We're not going to worry about that. You just be there 1 week from today with what you can carry. Where are you going? We can't tell you. How long? We can't tell you. Can you imagine the inhumanity of something like that being imposed upon American citizens?
When that order actually came out, was at that point there much of a cohesive community of Japanese Americans?
Not really, because I think we were all in a complete state of shock that our government would do this to its own based upon race. Complete shock.
Do you remember what your family did to prepare? You were 18 at the time, right?
Yeah, that's right. Well, I remember my parents, and I know a lot of other parents did the same thing. If we had photographs from Japan, and look, name me an ethnic group that does not have photographs from the old country, whether it be Italy, Israel, Germany,
Russia,
whatever. They burned them all. Some people burned heirlooms because they thought that if they had them, they would be considered suspect. And I personally remember, for example, I had some pictures of a cruiser, U.S. cruiser. You know, what American boy who sees a cruiser, one of his own ships going through the waters, would think that's so great? And I happened to have a little box camera, and I took a photo of it. I remember those being burned. The reaction, those are the kinds of things we did.
How about books or newspapers? Because, you know, it's Japanese Americans spoke Japanese, which is a foreign language in America.
Right. They even burned Bibles. I mean Bibles. Jesus Christ Bibles, which happened to be in Japanese. They burned Bibles in which I remember one instance where a Bible in the English language in which the reader apparently had made some notations in his native language, Japanese. He could read both Japanese and English. Those were burned because, you know, some FBI agent comes along and would read it and think that these are secret codes. The hysteria of it, the loss of any sense of perspective, the loss of any common sense and decency were just completely abandoned.
Did people take possessions that other than the bedding and the toothbrush and the clothing that they were allowed to bring, small things or things which were important because of family associations or heritage? Were people bringing those type of things?
Oh, I imagine there must have been some people who did. But the first thing you brought along was a survival kit. And as I mentioned to you before, people destroyed heirlooms. There were situations, incidentally, where people, rather than engage in distress sales, where somebody may offer you 10 cents on the dollar for something that is valuable, rather than face that kind of shame, I know of some instances where they just put in a big pile and set fire to it.
What would people do with their houses? I mean,
they had to abandon them. They tried to sell them at a distress sale if they could, and the vultures came from all around and tried to scavenge. In some instances, a neighbor would say, well, I'll take care of it for you. I'll harvest your crops for you. Well, yeah, they harvested it all right. They never got the money. The homes, if they came back to it, would be in shambles. Some of them were firebombed.
What was the reaction from neighbors that you did live with and all of a sudden are on another side of a fence, literally and figuratively?
Well, there were a number of the neighbors, Caucasians, who, of course, understood. They knew, say, me, my family, and understood that these folks are just good, decent, hardworking, law-abiding, loyal Americans. And so they were very understanding. But there are many, many others out there who are very ignorant and who had hate in their hearts, unfortunately.
What did parents tell their children, the Japanese-American parents, as a family is preparing to go to an internment camp?
They said very little, and let me explain why. Like any foreign stock, whether they're from Germany or European stock or from any other part of the world, our parents were hardworking, said very little, and they taught us, the children, to work hard, mind your own business, obey the laws, work and endure. And so when this tragedy, this great, awful tragedy befell us, they didn't have to tell us anything. We knew that this is what they expected us to do, to bear, to be patient, to hold up, and we'll somehow slug it through and see it through.
Were there parents that had to deal with, really legitimate fears or imagined fears of what was going to happen, from their children? Was there reassurance needed that, this is not forever, or this is not going to threaten your life? Or what was the sense of all that at that point?
No, I don't. My parents never conveyed anything like that to me. But I will say this. Incidentally, at the time the war broke out, one of my brothers was already in the U.S. Army. He was a sergeant in the Air Force. That didn't mean a thing, by the way, of course. We still were hauled off to the barbed wire camps. And this story can be multiplied by thousands. It didn't just happen to my family. My parents and many other parents told us, if they told us anything, you are American. You are American. Initially, whatever assurance they gave, and we ourselves believe this as American citizens, surely my own government would not do this to me, an American citizen. They might do a lot of other things which are unjust, but they wouldn't do it to a citizen. Unfortunately, we were wrong on that.
Was there resistance or discussion of resistance among either the younger generation or...
Well, I'll tell you, when someone has a gun to your head, whether it be a robber, and he says, hand me your money, you don't resist. When the U.S. government comes forth with tanks and soldiers with bayonets, helmets, steel helmets, and they say, you're going to move, you move if you want to stay alive.
There was that tone of...
Oh, no question about it, authority. And as I say, my parents, all of our parents, were law-abiding citizens, and when the government tells you to do something, they did it, even though they complied, even though they knew in their hearts it was wrong. And as I say, we who may be a little bit more Americanized say, wait a minute, this thing is wrong. Nevertheless, if they have a bayonet and a gun, you have no choice.
What are your recollections of the camps when you'd spent 6 months?
Yes, I did.
In camp?
First of all, the camps were in desolate areas. They're dust. Nothing growing there except sagebrush. There are no pavings. Mud. When it rained, it was mud up to your ankles. We were placed into tar paper barracks in a room approximately 20 by 25 for a whole family, sometimes two to a family. I remember when I first went in, there were two families, and we had to drape a sheet, you know, just for some degree of privacy. The only thought that I recall being behind the barbed wire fences and being an American boy, and by the way, I happened to be editor-in-chief of my high school newspaper. I was once student body president. I saluted the flag and pledged allegiance every morning, and at least in those days we had to. And I looked behind from those barbed wire camps and said, wait a minute. You know, there are German and Italian aliens. I'm not talking about German Americans or Italian Americans. We were at war with Italy and Germany as well. There were aliens who, for whatever reason, did not elect to become U.S. citizens, who were running around free on the other side of that barbed wire fence. And here I, an American, a true blue American, I'm on the wrong side of the fence with barbed wire fence, watchtower, searchlights. And I knew then, surely, there is something basically grievously wrong with this setup.
Did you witness much violence when you were
there? I myself did not witness any violence. However, during the course of the hearings of the commission, of which, I, as you mentioned, I'm a member, there have been, I recall, approximately about a half a dozen shootings. One of them involved, for example, a man who was seeking to scavenge some boards on the other side of the fence, of the barbed wire fence. He was shot. Another involved a little boy who happened to see a puppy running on the other side of the fence. And look, you know, if you don't have any pets at all in camp and you're a boy, or even if, whatever, you see a little puppy running around, you're going to reach out for it. He did. And he was shot.
What was the effect on the family units of, you know, having to live in without privacy and in close quarters, I guess, with nothing to do all day, right?
That's correct. What it did, basically, it destroyed the family unit. This is one of the things, like many other immigrant stocks, we pride ourselves. The family unity. You had, you know, the father was the head of the family. He was the dictator. And if he said jump, you said how high. And that's the way it was. And you minded your parents. And the way that was held together is you sat down with your parents, you ate with your parents, you had to hand in your report card to your parents, you had to account to your parents. Once we got into camp, we no longer ate together because it was like an army mess hall. Everybody took off each their different way, ate at different mess halls. And as a result, this most important retention of the family unit was destroyed. And the discipline began to crumble.
Do you have much contact with the outside world?
None whatsoever.
What did you believe about the war effort at that point?
Well, I hoped that the United States would win, as did many thousands of us, notwithstanding all of the terrible situation in which our government had placed us.
Well, you entered the military. I believe
I did.
You applied for the Navy, but ultimately weren't accepted. You served in the Army.
That's right.
Why weren't you accepted in the Navy, first of all?
Well, that's a little bit of a long story. All my classmates were volunteering. That is my Caucasian classmates. As I said, I left in about 6 months to go back to school. And so, you know, like any other American, I figured, well, I'll volunteer too. You know, this is my war just as much as anybody else's war, and my country's threatened. So I volunteered, and I wanted to fight in the Naval Air Corps. So I applied. and with my name Maritani, which sounds Italian. The application continued to be processed. The one thing I lacked, however, was my birth certificate, because I didn't take a birth certificate when I was uprooted. And I wrote back to the state of Washington, where I was born, and got my birth certificate, and finally sent up that last piece of document. In the meantime, by the way, the Navy was almost sending me letters every week saying, hurry up, because they wanted fighter pilots, and I was willing to go. Soon as they got my birth certificate and saw my parents, who my parents were, of my race, they sent all my papers back. And after that, well, I figured, well, what else can I do? And by the way, I was then classified 4C, I think it was, or 4E, I forgot what it was, which it was at the moment, which means an alien. An American citizen?
And you were born in America.
Yeah, an American citizen categorically being classified as an alien.
Well, when you went to Japan in the Army, it is a little hard to believe that you could go to what is the land of your ancestry after being interned by America and fight in the American Army against Japan without a lot of conflict, a lot of internal conflict.
No conflict at all whatsoever, any more than German Americans fought against Hitler. So I was willing to fight against Tojo, and about 8,000 of us did in the Pacific.
How did you react to the anti-Japanese sentiment of your fellow soldiers, in terms of fighting the Japs in Japan? How did you react to that? Because, you know, that might not have been making the distinction between ancestry and citizenship.
Actually, once you get into a unit, there's very little of that. Your buddies know you. They know what you are. They know which way you're pointing.
People were sensitive to that?
That was no problem. That was no problem.
How did the Japanese regard you? That is, the Japanese residents of Japan who you were there to fight or to...
Yes. Frankly, I thought that there might be some hostility on their part, seeing a Japanese face in an American uniform who obviously had fought against their own country, that is Japan, fought against the Japanese. But there was none of that. They seemed to understand, and indeed... they viewed me as an American, apparently without any conditions whatsoever. And by the way, I happen to be a military intelligence officer, so I studied Japanese in the U.S. Army and could speak, read, and write Japanese. So when I went over there as an American officer, first of all, I might back up and tell you that the children in Japan referred to me solely as an American, Amerikanjin, they kept calling me, Amerikanjin. And as you know, children are beyond guile. They will tell it like it is. So they viewed me. This told me that the Japanese viewed me as an American. Now, I remember one time I was working under MacArthur's headquarters, and we conducted a raid in Osaka, Japan, thinking that maybe the Japanese militarists still had some arms hidden away. And there was a superintendent of this munitions factory, and I went up to him and spoke to him in Japanese as to certain information. And he was absolutely flabbergasted that an American officer, even though with a Japanese face, could speak Japanese. And he said, "Would you please come home with me?" And I said, "What for?" He said, "I want my wife to meet you." He wanted to show me off that here was an American officer, an American soldier who could speak Japanese.
How did you react when... the children would call you an American.
That's the truth. I reacted as an American. Fine. Yes.
Were you regarded, though, as being a traitor to Japan?
No, I never ran into that. If there was any sentiment like that, it was never manifested. Not at any time.
Let's get back to talking about when people left the internment camps. I guess around 1945 was when the internment camps started to open. And people could return to their homes.
It was a little bit earlier than that, but yes.
Well, were people prepared to leave? I mean, to enter a larger world of...
No. Let me put you in a situation. Let's assume that we today put you in a camp, suitcase, toothbrush, et cetera, all right? Your home you've lost, your tractor you've lost, your farmland you've lost, and now they say we're going to let you out. It's in a hostile world yet. They haven't gotten over it. They say, all right, go out and hustle for yourself, friend. Can you be prepared? You have now been institutionalized to some extent. My parents, were now deprived of all the things that they had worked for so long, for so many years, and now suddenly being cut free. They had not saved up any money during the war years. While others were working in war plants and making money hand over fist, they were being paid if they worked at all. And by the way, the pay scale in the camps were $12 a month, $16 a month, and $19 a month. That comes out to about 75 cents a day at the maximum. You can't save anything with that. Even if you saved at all, you'd have practically nothing. Now you're cut loose and say, all right, fend for yourself. Are you prepared? Absolutely not.
How about although the camps were opened and people could go home, they're still entering the same world which had locked them up 3 years ago. How was that hostility anticipated by the people who were returning to?
Oh, you mean the people who were, say, in California?
Right. How did the people who were leaving the camps anticipate the wider world that they were returning to?
With a great deal of uncertainty, a great deal of reservation, and with some degree of fear, all of which were justified. You know, there were shootings and fire bombings, signs in California and elsewhere, no Japs wanted. They're still insisting on Japs. I mean, we who had served in the U.S. Army, there's a story of Senator Dan Inouye, who lost his arm in Italy fighting. And my brother, incidentally, another brother, also went into the, there were three of us who were in the Army, including myself. You know, here you are in a United States uniform, a veteran, fought to save this country, and you come back and you can't get a haircut. Can you imagine? In your own land, you can't get a haircut. That's what happened to Senator Inouye. And there are many, many, many other indignities like that that we faced.
Well, right now there's across the country a series of hearings and meetings with people who are demanding reparations. Can you summarize what reparations are being sought and why now, 40 years after, is this coming up at this point?
Let me first of all start off with the why 40 years later. When we were placed into the camps, that is not something to be proud of. There is a stigma attached to that. There's an implication that you were disloyal, even though it is absolutely untrue. In fact, we went out and proved our loyalty, as no Americans have. By the way, for example, the 442nd Regimental Combat Team, which is a unit comprised solely of Japanese Americans, came out of the war in Europe as being the most decorated unit in all the annals of American military history, beginning with the Civil War, for size of unit and length of service, for example. So we had really proved our loyalty, if any American has to prove their loyalty, and they shouldn't have to. But we did. As I mentioned to you before, 8,000 of us served in the Pacific against Japan. So we proved our loyalty. There's absolutely no question about that. But nevertheless, being thrown in summarily like a common criminal, and there was no charge against us whatsoever. As I mentioned to you before, J. Edgar Hoover said there's reported not a single instance of espionage or sabotage. But nevertheless, we were thrown in the camps. It is a little bit like a rape victim. You've been raped, and we were raped. Believe me, we were raped. And God Almighty, that they raped my parents as well. You know, if they raped me, somehow I'll survive, but they should not have raped my parents. And it is very hard to say I've been raped, that I was a rape victim. And it takes a long while to get over that. And after you mature and after you reflect and you say, you know, something dastardly was done to us, and somebody should respond to it. Our government committed a grievous wrong. Somebody should respond.
What's being asked of reparations? How?
Well, various figures are thrown around, tossed about, I should say. One of them is $25,000 per person that they incarcerated. That, incidentally, comes to $3 billion. That only shows you the magnitude of the of this gross injustice perpetrated on these people. And I don't think that the Nisei, the Japanese Americans, are so much interested in money. I know I'm not, and I'm not going to take a penny if the government offers it to me, because nobody can buy my liberty. Nobody can pay me for what they did. I'm not bitter about it. I'm still, as you know, I'm a judge, and I have to accept the past for what it is. But nobody has ever said, the government has never said, we were wrong. We were wrong. Now, in our society, the only way that you indicate that you were wrong, whether you breach a contract, commit an act of negligence against another, breach the antitrust laws, or commit a crime, one of the ways is by money. We no longer go eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, okay? So that's the medium. That's the way we, in our society, we acknowledge a wrong. And that is simply what is being sought. I would hope that whatever money they receive will go along to help, if they receive any, that is. And that would go along to help the elderly, the infirm, scholarships, etc. But again, I repeat, I myself will not take a penny.
Well, I wish we had more time to talk. Unfortunately, we are out of time. But thank you for coming here.
Not at all. My pleasure.
We've spent the last 40 minutes or so speaking with Judge William Muratani, who is a judge in the Common Pleas Court in Philadelphia. And he's very active in the Japanese American Citizens League on their National Committee for Redress, and also on the Commission on Wartime Relocation and Internment of Civilians. We've, of course, been talking about the internment of over 120,000 Japanese Americans during World War II on the West Coast. Thanks again for being here.
Not all. I do want to make one correction. I'm not on the National Committee for Redress. I'm just only simply on the commission.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Sorry.
Well, again, thanks for coming
not
today.
All.
It's about 20 minutes to 3 o'clock, and you're listening to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. And we're going to turn now to an interview with McCoy Tyner, who is a jazz pianist, played with John Coltrane in the early 1960s, and he'll be appearing next week at the Robin Hood Del West on the same bill as drummer Art Blakey. McCoy Tyner is known for his work with John Coltrane, and many of those sessions that he recorded are being reissued, and some of those are being issued now for the first time. In 1965, McCoy Tyner left John Coltrane to form his own group, and he worked with musicians like Ron Carter and Lee Morgan, John Henderson. And by the early 70s, he really had established himself as a band leader and with a readily identifiable approach to the piano. He was in Philadelphia about a year ago, and we were still at 46th Street. The WUHY studios were still at 46th Street at the time, and I recorded this interview with him there, and I asked him what kind of music training he got in Philadelphia.
Yeah, well, actually, this is my old stomping grounds right here, you know, 46th Market, and I lived on Fairmont Avenue between 46th and 47th, you know, around me and Fairmont. So when I first started playing, we had a sort of a beginner teacher around here, Mr. Habershaw. I don't know if he's still around or not, but he used to teach the younger children in the neighborhood. So, you know, I started taking lessons from him, and then I went to West Philadelphia Music Center, which was at 52nd and Walnut, I think.
It really is your old
stomping ground. Yeah, right. This is right here, and studied it for a while, and then went to Granoff Music School. Although at Granoff, I studied theory a little bit. You know.
Did you have much classical training?
A little bit. I think that I used to practice a lot. You see, I think the key to technique building is practicing every day. You know, I think that a consistent schedule. Some piano players or some musicians, they may practice. Younger guys, they will practice maybe 20 minutes one day, and then that's sort of thing. You know, but if you sort of establish a steady thing, a steady flow every day, practice maybe an hour or something like that a day.
What was the jazz scene like when you were growing up in Philadelphia? I mean, there were a lot of people here, people like Lee Morgan, Richie and Bud Powell lived around the block from you apparently for about a year.
That's right.
Tell us about that.
Very rich, very, very fertile for music. You know, I think it was one of the greatest scenes, you know, growing up here. You know.
Were you in touch with other musicians that are still in Philadelphia but didn't become as widely known as, you know, like Lee Morgan, for instance?
Yeah, there are a lot of great musicians still here. You had a lot of good guys, you know, that I knew, and where some of the older musicians, I think I credit them my success partially to their help and their support. There were a lot of guys that really helped me out a lot and gave me a lot of support
as a
teenager.
How about Bud and Richie Powell? Did you do much shedding with them or hanging out?
No,
musically?
No. Bud used to come by. He lived around the corner for a while because his family, I think, lives in Willow Grove, Pennsylvania. You know, they did. I don't know if they still do or not. But they had an apartment around the corner for me, and he used to come around. I think once he came around and played my piano, you know, when I was only about 15 years old.
What did that do to you?
Well, that was really great because we used to follow Bud around. You know, we had a place called Rittenhouse Hall up at, I think it was 53rd and Haverford, and we used to go up there and they had sessions. That was like a musician's place, and we used to jam all night. Some guys lived there, and we had dances on the weekend. So it was very interesting.
When did you meet John Coltrane?
I met John, I think, in the mid-50s. I think it was around 55.
Can you tell us about the beginning of that relationship? Because it's such a significant group of...
I think that during that period, that was a very important period in my life because I met my wife around the same time. And I met John around that time. As a matter of fact, he was with... this was a period where... an interim, you know, between being with Miles for the first time in the early 50s, he was with Miles Davis, and then he rejoined Miles later. But during this time, he was in Philadelphia, and his mother was here, and he was staying with her for a while. And I met him in this period, during this time, you know. We actually met with one afternoon. I was playing with a friend of his, Calvin Massey, who's also from Philly, you know, and we were playing at the place called Red Rooster. The building is still there. The club is named something else. And I happened to meet John. We had a matinee, and I met him one afternoon, actually.
What was your first sitting in like?
Well, actually, what happened is the club owner was familiar with John. He asked him, could he come in the next week? And John didn't have a rhythm section, so Jimmy Garrison, myself, and Albert Heath joined John, and we did the next week with him. So I was about 17 then. It was the first time playing with him. Yeah.
How was he as a leader, you know, in the early 60s when the quartet really started going?
Oh, he was a beautiful person to work for, you know. Very serious. It was a tremendous experience for me working with him because, you know, he was a genius as far as I was concerned.
Well, part of his genius was striking out in new directions almost constantly.
Yeah,
you know,
that's
every
right.
couple of years there'd be another real wealth of musical ideas mm-hmm. coming out of that. Now, as the pianist in that quartet, how did you follow that evolution of ideas?
Well, you had to grow along with it. See, that group was distinct because of the fact that it wasn't just a matter of following. You had to develop right along with the what was happening, you know. And I think John often said that he played according to what was around him as well. So we had to be right on the ball in order to really, you know, keep the thing happening. So it was a total group growth sort of thing. Yeah.
Did he, or did you rap about in a conceptual way some of the new directions?
No, they just happened. That's the ironic thing about it, is that they just happened naturally. And because we all were very serious about what we were doing and very dedicated to music. And when you take that sort of approach, I think that you don't have to just do too much discussing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so we had very few rehearsals. I can't even remember how many. Very few.
How would John Coltrane take the reviews when he'd move out into a new direction?
Well, I can't say that they didn't bother him at times. You know, sometimes he got a lot of the negative reviews about some of the things he was doing. You know, and of course there were some people who really believed, in what he was doing and really liked what he was doing. You know, but then there were some people who just couldn't adjust to the change. So therefore, he would get some sort of negative reviews. But we would take it in stride, and he remained firm, and we would give him a lot of, you know, confidence because we were right there with him, you know. See, so we'll just keep going, you know.
One of the interesting things, I first heard this, I guess, on Impressions, which is a real significant album that the quartet put out, is that you laid out during solos.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a really drastic, dramatic type of thing because, you know, there's not this, you're not comping, there's not this mm-hmm. this type of flow that you expect from a rhythm section.
Mm-hmm.
And then it gets down to something that really you can hear other rhythmic ideas that Coltrane was doing.
Yeah.
Why did you start doing that?
I objected to it at first. I didn't like the idea because I felt as though I was sitting here and doing nothing. But actually I wasn't, you know, really. I mean, it was just, it added another dimension to the music. Because Elvin and John had a chance to have an exchange, and actually, what it does is it creates a whole nother texture in the music because, you know, it gives it a little bit more freedom, you know, and then when the piano comes in, it can take it to another level, you know. So you give the artist, or you give the soloist a chance to really build something, you know, without, you know, and then you come in and if you want to, you know, take it into another direction, you can, or help him support what he's doing, what he's already built. So that was that type of thing. But it really worked well, I think, for the group, you know. Laying out, I really saw, and plus Johnny should play very long solo, so I didn't see. I realized it was a blessing in disguise.
Right, keeps the wrists and forearms cool for a little.
Yeah, that's right.
Was it hard to leave the quartet when you left? Why did you leave?
Well, actually, I left because before I left, I was thinking about leaving because I felt as though I wanted to try some things on my own. And then there was one main reason was I couldn't really hear myself. I was surrounded by Rashid Ali and mm-hmm. Elvin Jones mm-hmm. on either side of the stage, and I really couldn't hear the piano. The piano's not really, it's an acoustic instrument, and it only, it requires amplification because it is acoustic. And when you get surrounded by, you know, two drummers, you know, it's really difficult to, hear it. You see. So I really, some nights I couldn't hear hardly anything I was doing, you know. So, I asked him, I said, well, you know, what are you hearing? He says, well, I'm hearing a lot of drums, a lot of percussion things, mm-hmm, you mm-hmm. know. And I said, well, that's fine, but I'm getting really drowned out, you know. So, and then I felt as though it was time for me to leave.
Right. Well, I want to, in a couple minutes, talk about the directions that you went out into. Mm-hmm. But just one last question about that era.
Yeah.
It seems like in reading interviews that were done about that time or liner notes on albums that questions of political consciousness in the music or mm-hmm. or blackness in the music or, mm-hmm. or extra musical statements that would relate to the music were really important then. Mm-hmm. And how did you relate to those questions at that time?
Well, actually, I think there was a conscious level, I think, during that time. And in terms of the public at large, I think that people were identifying with certain things that were very important, you know. And we were sort of like within the flow of that thing. I think the whole atmosphere during that time, I mean, not only with the college students, but with the black people, with, you know, it was just a total society was going through changes. And I think there were a lot of good things that came out of that period. I think that a lot of good music, a lot of good poetry, a lot of just a lot of good things in general, because I think that sometimes things have to be shaken up in order for inventory to be taken. You know, mm-hmm, I think that mm-hmm. sometimes it's good for a country or a person or a community or whatever sometimes to take inventory. And I think that was inventory time. I think that it was also a very creative period. And I think that the music played a part. I think we were more or less functioning on the vibes that were created during that time.
Do you think those questions are at all relevant today?
Well, it's...
They're not asked as much.
Yeah, well, it's a little different situation today. As a matter of fact, in some ways, quite different, you know. I think that some of the seeds are still around. I think good things should remain. I think that in every period, I think that sometimes people have a tendency to discard good things very quickly. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes it's good to maintain those things, you know.
Well, when you left the quartet, you started as a leader. Mm-hmm. Was that at all like starting again in terms of working up again to a level of acceptance or a success?
To a point it was.
Was it difficult to do that?
Well, what it was, it shouldn't have been difficult, I don't think, but it was difficult because at the time you had the approaching factor of rock came in around that period, and it was like, it was a little detrimental in terms of, you know, the way it was thrust at people and the fact that a lot of the other music was really, like, sort of put aside.
Yeah, it really robbed the teen audience.
Yeah, it really did. And so, a lot of us suffered, not only me, but a lot of musicians, and also airplay and stuff like that. We didn't get a lot of music was really, you know, didn't get a chance to get exposed in the air, so it was a rough period during that time.
If I'm understanding the chronology right, by around the early 70s, you really started picking up momentum with what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah. One of the interesting things that I listen for in your new records as they come out, mm-hmm. or each time I see you, is perhaps there will be another new pianistic approach. Mm-hmm. One thing that occurs to me is I remember in the early 70s, somehow things started sounding very percussive, mm-hmm. Very aggressive. Mm-hmm. Am I communicating?
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Yeah.
Where do those new approaches happen? Is that something that happens, like you were saying with Coltrane? It happens as you're playing the tunes, or do you sit at home and stumble on something?
Well, I think it's not always conscious. I think that or contrived. I think that when it's that type of thing, sometimes it's not a natural change. It's a thing that I never try to predict natural changes. Mm-hmm. I feel as though they should happen naturally, and rather than sit down and say, well, let me just come up with something new, I think that, the atmosphere, sometimes the guys that I'm working with, and, it's various, there are many reasons why those things take place.
Okay, but when you hear something coming, can you hear the germ of a new idea?
Yes, you can.
When that's happening, when something's evolving, are there mistakes or is anything fair game will you lay low on something until you understand what you're trying to do?
No. It may come in pieces. It may develop in time. And so therefore it's not really a mistake. What it is, it's just an interjection of something new, which will in turn develop into a complete thing. You mm-hmm. see, so it's not really like making a mistake. It's like just adding something, and then that particular thing would germinate and grow, and to like the idea will eventually mature like a person. So you don't make any mistakes because you're growing from 5 to 6. It's just that type of thing.
It's something that's going to happen, and you're just
a part of the flow of it. And it just develops. As you go along.
Well, many critics aren't so kind to look at it that way. So how do you react to criticism?
Well, I like constructive criticism, but I'm afraid that a lot of the critics don't criticize or don't view things constructively. What they do, they sometimes try to persuade the thinking of the people, or they don't particularly like an artist personally, or for some reason. I found that a lot of that goes on instead of a constructive sort of criticism, or really trying to assist an artist, especially an artist that's been established. I feel as though that to deal with that artist harshly or unfairly, I think it's really not good. I think that the person in that position should be conscious of the fact that they do have people out there who aren't aware, or they may be aware or something like that, but just maybe not so sure. And then you take a guy who's insensitive to an artist who has done a lot of good things, and maybe one thing he doesn't particularly like, and he tries mm-hmm. to, and he really crucifies that person. I think that's not fair.
Well, you've been doing a lot of touring in the last decade, a lot of international traveling, mm-hmm. and there also have been appearing some African and Asian type influences, just like mm-hmm. in terms of the instruments, some mm-hmm. of the references for the titles of the tunes, and so mm-hmm. forth. How has traveling affected your? Do you go to a country and pick up on something specifically?
Or? Yeah, well, what happened is, I think when I was with John, we were very international in our approach to music. And I like that approach because what it does is it gives you options musically. I think that you can do various things, receive various types of influences and really make them make what you're doing broader, And I kind of like that. It gives you more musical options. And, there are a lot of things. I think sometimes I feel like when I write a song, I may think of a particular place and say, wow, that'd be nice to write a song about this place. Or sometimes it happens the other way, around. Sometimes I'll write something that sounds like India, or that sounds mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Africa or whatever. But I like that sort of approach, rather than to get locked in a particular thing. I think compositionally I like to have that. The freedom to do that.
How do different audiences react to you? Different parts of the world react differently?
Yes. Yes, they do.
Are there things that work some places that aren't as successful at others and vice versa?
Well, I found out that what it is that audiences are different in particular places, not because of the music that we play, but because of the general character of the people. Like we were in Europe in the early part of this year, and the countries varied. We played in Spain, we played in Germany, quite a few places in Germany, England, and the people are just they're different, just because nature-wise. I mean, the way they respond to things, some are stiffer than others, mm-hmm, but mm-hmm. some. It's funny, we played for some audience, someone mentioned the country, but we played for some audience, and it took the second set before they actually got into the music. The first set they were sitting like, well, I don't know, maybe we shouldn't loosen up and absorb this. Then the second set, they loosened up, and the audience was very, they really got into the music. So I think that it all depends on, where you are. It's not so much the music.
How do you think your playing has influenced other players? There's obviously a lot of influence. Are you conscious of it?
Yeah, I am.
How do you feel about it? I mean, some musicians will go so far as to say they feel ripped off. Other musicians will say, you know, well, if that's what happens, that's how it is. It's okay. And other, you know, mm-hmm. what's your sense of that?
Well, I mean, I don't feel like I'm ripped off because I don't really think that, you know, I don't really think that that they really have, you know, captured, you know, my total personality. It's impossible for somebody to do
that's
that.
That's certainly true.
Yeah, I don't think you can really assume someone else's musical character and really be that person. I think that so the influence is it's wonderful that they like what I'm doing. You know, it's just that I feel as though, you know, if it becomes a situation where an individual is, you know, like say for instance, held down while another guy takes off on another person's style, I don't think that's so good. But that sometimes that happens, you know. But not in my particular case. I think that, you know.
Do you think that a younger player listening to you and being influenced by you needs magnificent chops to be able to?
No. I think that technique is only good when you need it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that to be able to express the ideas that you have, it's good to practice and develop like technical, you know, have technical ability, you know. But I don't think that I think that your technique should grow along with your ideas. You know, just running all over the piano and playing a lot of notes is not really the answer. I only do that when I really feel it's necessary to do it, you know. But otherwise, I don't. Just to do it just for the sake of being an exhibitionist, it doesn't make any sense.
I spoke with McCoy Tyner about a year ago when he was in Philadelphia, and McCoy will be back in town next Wednesday at 8 p.m. at the Robin Hood Del East. If I said Robin Hood Del West before, I stand corrected. It's the Robin Hood Del East. And he'll be on the same bill as Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers. That'll be next Wednesday at 8 p.m. And I can give you a number for further information, GR77402. That's GR77402. And there's fairly inexpensive general admission for that concert available. It's about a minute after 3 o'clock, and you're listening to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. My name's Danny Miller. I'm sitting in for Terry Gross as she winds down to the last couple days of her summer vacation. At 3:30, we'll hear Frances Davis in this week's edition of Interval. It's from the Interval Archives. It'll be an extended edition on Billie Holiday. And at about 4:20, we'll hear from John Sayles, who, of course, is the director and acted in and wrote The Return of the Sea Caucus 7. And he also did quite a bit of work with Roger Corman, and he'll be talking about all of that at about 4:20. Throughout the rest of this week, and also next Monday at 3 o'clock, we'll be hearing highlights of the French Jazz Festival recorded in 1979 and produced for broadcast by the NPR member station in Newark, WBGO. Today's program features two Benny Goodman veterans, Warren Bechet and Scott Hamilton, and also pianist Dave McKenna, who will be playing by himself, as well as with Warren Bechet and Scott Hamilton, and also Clark Terry's big band. So let's hear part two of the 1979 French Jazz Festival.
From Joan Le Pen in France, welcome to the second in a series of French Jazz Festival highlights. Hi, I'm Rob Crocker. And today we'll be treated to a program of swing revivalists in performance at the 1979 Joan Le Pen Jazz Festival. Taking part will be young swing artists Scott Hamilton and Warren Bechet, pianist Dave McKenna, plus Clark Terry and his Big Bad Band. The music opens with a performance by a most unusual octet. On trumpets, veteran Snooky Young teams up with a youthful member of Benny Goodman's band, Warren Bechet. On saxophones, Marcia Royal, the longtime lead altoist of the Count Basie Orchestra, is paired with young tenor sensation Scott Hamilton. And in the rhythm section, guitarist Herb Ellis is joined by Ross Tompkins on piano, Michael Moore on bass, and Jeff Hamilton is the drummer. Together, they're an all-star octet. Thank you. C-Jam Blues, as performed by Scott Hamilton, Warren Vaché, and an all-star octet from the 1979 Juan Le Pan Jazz Festival. Festivals like Juan Le Pan attract American jazz musicians on a regular basis. The seaside location of the French Riviera makes the site an especially popular stop on the European tour, with the added advantage of performing in front of an appreciative European jazz audience. Trumpeter Warren Vaché, who we just heard, has played in Europe on several occasions, both in the company of Scott Hamilton and as part of the Benny Goodman Group. In a recent interview, Vaché spoke about some of the differences between the European and American jazz audiences.
I've played relatively few clubs in Europe. I do mostly... the stuff I've done in Europe has been concerts. And I don't find, frankly, much of a difference in the concert audience in Europe than I do here. There are times when I think they're all out for blood, and they would rather see you strain and see veins popping in your neck and use beads of perspiration forming on your brow than they would listen to the music, just as I feel here. Clubs, as I say, I've got a limited frame of reference in Europe as when it comes to clubs. I've played two or three of them. That will be the Pizza Express in London, and a club called the Musabeka in Stockholm. And they're much like working American clubs. Again, the same. A club is a wonder. I'd rather work in a club than anywhere, you know. At this point in my life, I feel as though I'm under a microscope in a concert situation many times. I'm maybe a little bit too self-conscious. I don't like people sitting down and staring at me. I can't get away from that, you know. And so that's why I like clubs. You can have a taste and have a little conversation. And when something happens, I mean, I figure if the music is that good, it's going to get 95 or 90%, at least 90% of the people in the room's attention anyway. But it is, it's a music of audience in response to me, too. And people feel more responsive in a more natural way in a club than they do in a concert hall.
Trumpeter Warren Vaché, from whom we'll hear more a bit later on. Another highlight from the 1979 Juan Le Pan Festival was a freewheeling performance of Clark Terry's Big Bad Band. Clark Terry is no newcomer to the world of big bands. Even before he first formed his big band a decade ago, he had already served an apprenticeship with the orchestras of Duke Ellington and Count Basie. Clark brings to his big band performances the same energy and drive which permeate his solo work. Like an earlier trumpeter and big band leader, Dizzy Gillespie, Clark also brings a talent for pure showmanship, with an occasional vocal or two. And he brings a deep love and appreciation for that most venerated musical idiom, the blues. The Clark Terry Big Band.
Thank you. great big legs. Yeah, and she's built up from the ground. From the ground. Ooh, every time I see her coming near me, my love just comes a tumbling down. Yeah, but she's a mean mistreated woman. And she don't mean no one man no good. Maybe 4, 6, 8, 12 Army, Navy, CIA, things like that. She's a dirty, low-down, stinking, greasy, cheesy, chitlin'-eating woman. Woo! She don't mean no one man no good. No kind of good. Yeah. Yeah, she is. But you know one thing, I don't blame that woman. Woo! 'Cause I would be the same way if and I could. Dig that if and, that's Harvard language. If and I could. I don't know what's wrong with my woman. She ain't acting right at all. I don't know what's wrong with my woman. Woo! She ain't acting right at all. Yeah, but if she don't straighten up soon and start acting decent, I'm gonna take back my wig and let her hair go bald. Yeah. We'll be right back.
The Clark Terry Big Band with Warm-Hearted Blues, written by Yusef Lateef. You heard Clark's trumpet playing and singing, as well as the trombone playing of Al Crook, an electrifying solo by tenor saxophonist Bill Saxon. Clark Terry's Big Bad Band. Next, we'll return to two young stars, Scott Hamilton and Warren Vacher, who are joined by Dave McKenna, guitarist Cal Collins, bassist Michael Moore, and drummer Jake Hanna. Let's hear what this all-star sextet comes up with for the festival audience here at Juan Le Pen. T for Two with tenor saxophonist Scott Hamilton, trumpeter Warren Vache, Dave McKenna, Cal Collins, Michael Moore, and Jake Hanna from the 1979 Juan Le Pan Jazz Festival. You've been listening to a program of highlights from the 1979 French Jazz Festivals. This series is a production of WBGO Newark. We'd like to thank Radio France for recording the festival and to the European Broadcasting Union for making them available. The executive producer for this series is Al Pryor. Post-production was by Ed Scarvalone and George Achevese. I'm Rob Crocker, inviting you to be with me next time when we'll hear from Horace Silver, Johnny Griffin, and Barney Kessel performing at the Paris Jazz Festival. Thanks for listening. This is the Public Radio Cooperative.
And this is WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. We hear that program of the Paris 1979, French 1979 Jazz Festival tomorrow at 3 o'clock. And on Monday at 3 o'clock, the performance from the Jazz Festival will be by the Mingus Dynasty Band. Right now it's about 3:31, and you're listening to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. Every Thursday at about this time, we hear from Francis Davis at Interval. And today we're taking the interval from our archives. This is a special extended interval which Francis Davis prepared on Billie Holiday.
Listening to Fresh Air, I'm Francis Davis, and Interval today might well be subtitled Billie Holiday in so many words. My commentary on this series is generally not the kind that relies on anecdotes to make its points, but today it will be. Not all the anecdotes are my own, though they have become mine, of my having heard them or read them, and of my shameless need to make them mine. I'll offer no summary of Billie Holiday's life or career, and no analysis of her vocal style. In other words, I'll try not to cover the ground already covered by so many others with varying degrees of success, including Billie Holiday herself. The Billie Holiday story, with its tribulations, its squalor, its troubled dignity, and ultimately its transcendence, is one of the great American stories, but it's a story that rises specifically from Black America. James Baldwin titled a book about similar kinds of experiences, Nobody Knows My Name, but everybody knows her name, the statistics of her existence. What I want to know is out of what dark power she conjured her art. And I want to see the woman, the invisible woman, to play on Ralph Ellison's apt phrase, or the invisible lady we conjure when nothing or no one else will do. Amiri Baraka called her the Dark Lady of the Sonnets, referring to that repository of mystery and desire in Shakespeare, and said this about her: nothing was more perfect than what she was, nor more willing to fail. More than I have ever felt to say, she says always. More than she has ever felt is what we mean by fantasy. Emotion is wherever you are. She stayed in the street. The myth of the blues is dragged from people, though some others make categories no one understands. A man told me Billie Holiday wasn't singing the blues, and he knew. Okay, but what I ask myself is what she had seen to shape her singing so. What in her life proposed such tragedy, such final hopeless agony? Or flip the coin and she is singing Miss Brown to you, and none of you cats would dare cross her. One eye closed, and her arms held in such balance as if all women were so aloof, or could laugh so. And even in the laughter, something other than brightness completed the sound, a voice that grew from a singer's instrument to a woman's, and from that, those last records critics say are weak, to a black landscape of need and perhaps suffocated desire. Sometimes you are afraid to listen to this lady.
My days have grown so lonely, for you I cry, for you kneel only. Why haven't you seen it? I'm all for you, body and spend my days in longing. You know it's you that I am longing. Oh, I tell you I mean it. I'm all for you, body and soul. I can't believe it, it's hard to conceive it, that you throw away romance. Are you pretending it looks like the ending? Unless I can have one more chance to prove, dear, my life a wreck you're making. You know I'm yours for just the taking. Oh, I tell you I mean it. I'm all for you, body and soul. For you that I